All right. This is David Wolford. I'm with Mr. Darrell Owens in Louisville. Today is July 13th, 2006. How are you today, Mr. Owens?
Doing fine.
I just want to talk to you a little bit today about your experience in growing up in Louisville and race relations in Louisville in the 50s and 60s. And then also we'll turn to the desegregation lawsuit and Judge Gordon's order from the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about who you are and growing up in Louisville and you know, your life at in education in Louisville.
Well, I obviously born in Louisville. My earlier years were spent in an area called Fort Hill. At that time, the city was fairly segregated in terms of housing patterns. And subsequently, I moved to an area called Shepherd Square, which is a housing project. I attended a school which no longer is in existence on Fort Hill. That's Hill Street out by Shelby. It's called Lincoln School. And then I attended high school at Jackson Junior High School, which is now Mazique High School. And attended at Central at that time, because that was the only school outside of Catholic High, I think, that African Americans could attend. A lot of times I'd walk to school from Shepherd Square to the Central, which is about 12, 13, 14, 15 blocks. And you would pass St. Xavier High School, which was on Broadway at that time, between 2nd and 3rd, I believe. And sometime you would pass Mail if you came down Brackenridge, which you could not attend at that time. And, you know, went to Central. I think I got a good education. You had a lot of dedicated teachers at that time. Of course, the other side of the coin is the teachers couldn't go anywhere else. African-American teachers, and many of them had masters, some even had PhDs. Their teaching opportunities were severely limited because you only had one high school. I think you had two junior highs, Madison and Jackson at that time. And of course you had a bunch of elementary schools. So, you know, for those who were trained in education, the opportunities were somewhat limited by the schools. Other than that, I guess I'll entertain any questions. That's basically the long and short of it. I will say that I was the first class to go into the new Central to spend the whole, I think it was 3 or 4 years, I forget mm-hmm. what it was back then.
Well, did the new one was went up in something like 52, is that correct?
Yeah, I roughly? Guess that's when it was, and my class was the first class to go in, as I guess as freshmen, and spend the whole 3 years at that school, so I never attended the old Central High School, which was down in Nathan Chestnut, I believe.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of that elementary school that you attended?
Lincoln Elementary.
Oh, you said that, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you have Lyman Johnson as a teacher?
No, I Lyman was in the room next to me. I took my civics and I guess social studies from a gentleman by the name of Mr. Bishop. And Lyman was in the next room. I never had Lyman, but Lyman had a tremendous impact upon me, as he did many people over the period of his life. This is a man that fought for equal pay for teachers. Mm-hmm. Some teachers were even afraid to ask for it. He was sort of a stand-up guy. And
did most children know him even before they would be in his classroom?
Yeah, I said something about Lyman. You knew Lyman. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, I think you have to realize we probably knew all the teachers. There are some better than others. But if it was one facility and, you know, during the course of your stay there, you generally probably ran into Matt or took classes from most of the teachers. But I never took a class from Lyman. All of my classes were from Mr. Bishop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you recall about Central High School in terms of, you know, the education there? Or did you play any sports or
No. The
relationship between maybe the students, that the community that existed there?
Well, it was community because that was our school. We had the outstanding football team and we had the outstanding basketball team. At that time, I don't think we could play for the state championship, at least initially. It was one of those things where everybody knew everybody. Teachers knew your parents. Back in those days, the worst thing in the world was for the teacher to call your parent. Now, maybe the parent would get, teacher get cussed out, but in those days, in my house, and there was no explaining. If the teacher called and said this, that, and that, there was no explaining. If the teacher said it, that was it. In the subject, and whatever came as a result of that, came as a result of that. So it was one of those things where, you know, it was community. I think that, I don't want to say it was a focal point, but in terms of high school, most of the African-American kids attended that school, and of course their parents, to the extent that they were involved, was involved in that high school. The teachers went to the same churches and other activities as parents, so it was a community. I think, you know, where everybody sort of looked out for everybody else.
Let's see. Now, you graduated from Central High School in 1955.
Uh-huh.
Do you recall offhand when the Brown ruling in 54, the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, when that came down, did the black community in Louisville or the student body at Central, was there any kind of a response to that?
Not that I recall.
It was so distant, probably, that it didn't seem like it was going to happen overnight?
Well, of course, you know, at that point I was young, and I'm not really sure that we understood the import of it. You know, it took a couple of years for all deliberate speed, and we're still in all deliberate speed.
Right.
So, you know, it took a while to for those things to, I guess, come into place. I think at that time, was Carmichael the superintendent?
Yes, he was.
And Carmichael, as I recall, was not a man who, I think, would go overboard to be of assistance to African-Americans, as I recall it. Again, it's vague. I'm a little
That
old.
Seems to be the attitude, yeah, or the opinion I've heard, yeah, pretty much across the board.
And so, I mean, you know, obviously you would not expect much, as I recall, from him in terms of progressive thinking or taking the bull by the horn and doing the right thing. So, you know, again, I don't I don't recall any
celebration or any, right?
It could have been, you know, I'm up in age now. So
I understand.
I forget.
Now, so when you graduated from Central, where did you go from there?
Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio. And then from there I went to Howard University Law School in Washington, D.C.
Are you, had anybody in your family gone to college before?
My sister went to Central State. I had an aunt who had gone to college years earlier. She'd gone to the University of Chicago. She got a master's in social work. Sort of tough on her. She went to the old municipal college because, you know, at that time, African Americans, when she grew up, couldn't attend U of L.
Mm-hmm.
And so she went to what they call the old municipal college, which was the black, and since it's been merged into U of L, was the black college for, for African Americans, blacks at that time. Because you couldn't go to U of L in case else.
Were you the first lawyer in your family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yes.
All right, so when you came back here, you came
65.
Back in the mid-60s. Okay,
uh-huh.
65. What? Uh-huh. When did you get involved in the NAACP? How do you remember that coming about?
Well, I think I probably got involved fairly soon after. As I recall, there were demonstrations and open housing demonstrations and those types of things, and being an attorney, you sort of got involved in the peripheral. There were some older attorneys who were taking the lead on these particular cases, but you were there to offer any assistance that you could. You know, the cause was the cause that everybody in our community felt was worthy of fighting for, and we all contributed what we could to it.
Do you remember James Crumlin?
Oh, yeah.
What? Tell me a little bit about him.
James Crumlin was a gentleman who never got the measure of credit that I think he was entitled to. James Crumlin traveled the state at great risk to fight for the cause of civil rights when it was not paying. When you get attorney's fees and things, there was a number of fights that, you know, got involved in. I'm not saying that they wouldn't have gotten involved in another way, but Jim did it when it was a risk to his life. There was no money involved. He did so much for this state community. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, Jim just never seemed to have gotten the credit or the acknowledgement of his efforts that I think he was entitled to.
He seemed to be very active immediately, you know, when desegregation started across the state. And then it seemed like after about mid-60s or something, I know he was still living in town and everything, he kind of, well, I wouldn't say disappeared, but he wasn't as active. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, I would assume you had a new breed coming on. You had Sadler who did the deseg case at U of K. He may or may not even know Jim. I don't know if he made contact with him to get involved in it. It's one of the things. It was sort of a new breed, and the Sadler took that, as I recall, and Tim Hogan, they were the two, and then I got involved as just sort of representative of the NAACP, because I forget exactly when that case was filed.
72, I think.
Okay. So, you know, it's one of those things that I'm not really sure Jim, as a matter of fact, you look at the case, but for my involvement in NAACP, it was handled primarily by white lawyers.
Mm-hmm. To get back to Crumlin just a second, did you know him personally?
Sure.
Can you give me a little bit of his personality?
He was a strong guy, very likable guy.
Was he a minister?
Passionately, yeah. He at some later date he became a minister. He felt passionately about this issue of civil rights and how African Americans were treated. I don't know how else you can explain what he did, realizing the great risk. You know, you were out in the state in Kentucky back then for these causes. I mean, you was taking your life in your hand. You know, right now it seems silly, but it wasn't silly back then. I mean, it was serious business. And Jim, I think he was a state president at one point. I mean, Jim traveled this state, the length and breadth of the state. That was a cause. Jim was there at no cost. He didn't get paid. And like I say, it had to be a cost to him in terms of his practice, because he couldn't be here practicing if he's down in Adair County or in Western Kentucky doing something else. And I'm sure that, you know, to some extent, the National Office, the Legal Defense Fund, you know, offered some assistance. But Jim, he's passionate. When you think about what he did, I guess the only regret I have is Jim died without, at least in my opinion, the recognition that he was entitled to. But that's just my personal opinion.
Did you come across James Earl Deering? I think you just went by, did you just go by Earl Deering?
Earl Deering. I knew Earl. He was the first black prosecutor, I think, for our police court here. Dating myself. All these guys are gone. I was a young buck when
I think he died pretty early. Or he died in like 69 or something. So
he was a Republican. As a matter of fact, Jim was a Republican.
Is that right?
Yes, okay. Jim was a Republican. Strong Republican. And Earl Deering, I think he was the first African American elected as a prosecutor here in what we call the old police court system. And he was involved. All these guys were involved in, you know, sit-ins and representing folks, or you know, those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
They all gave. I mean, you didn't have to ask. I mean, you just sort of did it. I mean, if you didn't do it, you felt bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, I knew Deering.
And then what was the local Louisville NAACP chapter? You know, how would you define it or the relationship? It seemed like sometimes Lyman was in charge of it, sometimes Crumlin was in charge. You know, when you came, when you got involved with that, what was the chapter like? Was there monthly meetings?
You had monthly meetings, and it was Lyman, and then there was a W.J. Hodge.
Reverend
W.J. Hodge. He was also, as a matter of fact, there was a period, that's after them, I served as president for a year or two. But that's Lyman, Crumlin, W.J. Hodge, I'm trying to remember old school guys. Yeah, I remember.
Was the chapter usually in agreement when they would take a move to do something?
Yeah, or? I mean, I think they were fairly much in agreement. And of course, you have to realize back then the exit discrimination was fairly obvious. So, I mean, you know, it was one of those things you... Now it's a little more subtle. But then, I mean, you know, it hits you in the face every day. And so the causes were there. So, you know, had open housing and public accommodations, being able to eat in a restaurant downtown, being able to go in a store. I mean, when I was growing up, you'd go to the store, you couldn't try clothes on. Mm-hmm. Mother had to hold them up to you, but she couldn't try them on. So, you know, there were many causes, and, you know, I think there was much unanimity in terms of what you were going to undertake at that point. You know, whatever they decided the particular issue was. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so as the story goes, Louisville integrated at least in a token fashion in 56. You know, it was under Carmichael. And then there was very little increase in integration until after this lawsuit that happened in the 70s. That was really the whole argument for the lawsuit, that in reality...
You had vestiges of
the dual system. Mm-hmm. I guess my question here is, why did Louisville not desegregate more progressively in the 60s? You know, what was it that happened that slowed that process down? There was this national acclaim, you know, for the integration in the beginning because there was no riot in 56. And then, even if that was token, you know, for that week, it was pretty big news. What happened in the 60s for there to be such a accusation in 72?
Well, I think the fact was that, you know, the schools were really not desegregated. There were, you know, there were few schools where, you know, they did it. It wasn't truly a desegregated, because now I don't call the schools integrated, I call them desegregated, because within schools, there's still, you know...
Factions,
you put blacks here and whites there, you know. So at that time, I think the effort was that we wanted to desegregate our community. You still had the vestige, you still had segregated neighborhoods to a great extent, you know. Open housing hadn't really taken hold at that time, and so we all had, you know, parts where black folks live here and white folks live there and never shall the two meet, you know, and that type of thing. So I think it was a commitment at that time to proceed. And again, I don't recall exactly how that started, because I think Settler and Tom was already on it, and then I think NACP or I was requested to be a part of
sort
it,
because
they felt it was important that the NAC be a part of it. Obviously, I mean, you're talking about desegregating that two white lawyers.
Right. That, you know. Why was that the case? Why were they taking the lead on this? Were they wanting it more? Was the civil liberty? Is the Kentucky?
Who was the plaintiff? Was Lyman the plaintiff?
Well, there was a handful. Lyman was definitely one of the plaintiffs, and Susie Post was officially one of the plaintiffs. Okay. And I guess there was a series of them.
I guess, you know, they might have, you know, again, taking on this case is not a small matter. And, of course, if you just get a regular lawyer, it's going to take up a great deal of time. Settler, I think, probably did this pro bono.
Sure he did, yeah.
He's a professor at UOK, and, you know, this is part of him doing it. So, I mean... He had the time and the resources and the ability to devote the attention to it that maybe a private counsel couldn't. I don't recall how it came that way. I know that was the way it was. But, you know, I assume Susie and Lyman, they might have done it through ACLU initially. I have no idea.
They did, I think. Yeah. Now, was there a relationship between the NAACP and the KCLU before the suit ever took place? Sure. I think I even saw your name on the as a board member of the KCLU. Is that correct?
I was at one point a member of the Board of American Civil Liberties Union.
Okay.
So, I mean, there was a relationship because many of the same issues, you know, we were dealing with. So, I mean, there wasn't any hostility or anything.
Right.
So, you know, again, my best guess would be that either the national office of the NACP hadn't made a decision to come in and do it, because obviously if you take on something like that, you want the national office to at least give you all the research and help you draft briefs and memorandums and that type of stuff. Of course, Sadler, he sort of did this. I mean, I saw Sadler sit down and dictate briefs. Mind boggling. yeah. But I mean,
he was a sharp guy. It seems also that in reading this that the initial move by Hogan and Sadler was to sue for a merger, and then it seems to me like either you or the NAACP or the black community, the voice came out that we don't really want to merge. We just want greater levels, a greater degree of integration here. Is that pretty correct there?
As I recall it, Vicky, I'd have to look at it, because so much of that, I mean, I haven't really looked at that, although merger did eventually come. And the problem is that African-Americans lost in that.
To explain that a little bit better, what did the African-American community, how do they look at merging with the county district?
Well, it's one of those things wherever you have merger, whether it's city government or whatever, you narrow your options. You know, back then, you know, I guess it would be unthinkable to have a black principal at a white school. Of course, you'd be unthinkable to have a white principal at Central. So, you had, when you merged it, you had layers of administrators, and you know, had to merge them, and we lost a lot of them. I think eventually we lost them all.
So it was just stood to lose more.
It's just the nature of the beast, you know. If you have white people that hit it up, I mean, it's like anything else. You know other white people better than you know African Americans. I mean, you might socialize with them. You might go to the same church with them. You might have gone to the same school together. So, you know, those are the people that sort of, you know, moving at those levels. I often tell folks, if you look at employment, most of the jobs are not filled through advertisements. Most of the jobs are filled by word of mouth, people telling folks. And if you're not in a position to know it, and if you know it, you're not in a position to help somebody get in, then it just doesn't happen.
So the old network, I guess, was the reason. That's what you talk about, administrators and things.
Whatever the reason, the problem, the result was the same. We lost them.
Gotcha. I think I got this right. The local NAACP in 1969, this is a couple years before the suit, they actually filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights out of D.C., do you recall much? Do you recall how that went down, or what?
I mean, I don't even recall what the complaint was about.
I think it was just the same basic argument: schools weren't integrated enough. The faculty was not shuffled up.
Well, it was, and I think one of the concerns that I think a lot of African Americans had is that resources were not the same. Black school got the older books. White school got the newer books. I think what they tried to do is make it separate but equal by giving you nice buildings.
That was the first
central. Nice building. But in terms of resources, I guess one of my most memorable event about this whole thing, like I told you, I was in the first class to go in there. And I was in 52, I guess, if you say.
Something like that, yeah.
And at that time, they were talking about putting that track in over at Central. Back in 52. And I remember when Gordon's order, when the order came down out of Sixth Circuit, and we met over in, Woodson, Hobson represented the other school board, Woodson, I think. We was in that office. I think Newman Walker was the superintendent, wasn't he?
City board, yeah. Was it Henry Triplett was the attorney?
Well, Triplett wasn't in this meeting.
Okay.
And they were sitting over figuring out how we're going to get this thing ready to go. Because, you know, the order came down and the SEG order started that September. And I recall so clearly them talking about we have to put a track in Central. Now, remember, I went down 52 and they promised us a track way back in 52. never got it. I recall the discussion about the track. That track was in when school started. That track was in when school started.
From the time the desegregation order came in the summer till the...
When school opened in September, they had a... You go out there, you see Central, you see the track.
So something
they
that...
They had promised us since 52. I never forget it. I was just dumbfounded. Because then, you know, they talked about... I remember sitting up there talking about curriculum. And, you know, the whole thing. Because, you know, they want... Now we have to lift these schools up. Of course, the argument has been the schools are okay. Well, why do you have to redo the curriculum if they're okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I never will forget that discussion. Because I remember when we went there, we were going to get a track. Let me do this. And I just recall that so vividly. And you know, the irony, when you talk about DSEG, I immediately saw the impact of it.
The 75 got, order you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. The Central got a track that was promised when I went there in 52. They got the track in a short time. When that school opened, the track was there.
And this is amid all the other costs that went up, the busing and the, you know, all the other things they had to do. They made sure that that happened.
It was just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You know, I remember talking about the curriculum. I'm saying, well, all the curriculums supposedly are the same, you know, but you know, that's neither here nor there.
Right. What did the, you know, and I don't mean to generalize. I know that a lot of times.
Well, I'm gonna have to generalize about specifics.
Yeah. No, it's okay for you too. But sometimes I'll generalize in a question, and it's not really fair. But you know, and I think you can probably gauge this, even if you don't remember specific dates and stuff. But you know, what was the feeling amongst the African American community on balancing enrollments? And mixing up the student bodies.
I think at that time that the judgment was that this was what had to happen to give the kids a quality education. And I had two daughters.
Where'd they go to school, by the way?
One wound up going to PRP. And the other one went to Mill, but graduated from Central. She hated Mill. She thought it was a racist school.
Came back to Central.
No, she didn't go to Central.
I thought, she went. She graduated from Mill, is that what you said?
No, she graduated from She went to Mill, but she graduated from the Brown School.
Okay.
And my other daughter graduated from PRP.
And that was in late 70s, I guess? Or
late 70s, I would say, yeah.
What was that experience like as a parent? Or watching your kids go through this... I guess they were.
It was one of those things where, you know, I think at that time we felt we had to do it. We felt we were giving our kids a leg up educationally. We were left, you know, an interesting thing. I recall my daughter bringing home a Chinese girl to sleep over. And I remember my daughter going to somebody's house in the East End, I don't know who it was. I spent the night. That would have never happened in a segregated school.
No, to a white kid's home in the East End?
Yeah. I recall my youngest daughter now has a friend of hers that she's in Italy. Because she was Italian or whatever. And she eventually left him and went over to Italy and lived with the family. And they still stay in contact.
Hmm.
So you see those kind of dynamics.
Like there probably was no exchange student program, is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, this was just a friend of my daughter's that now lives in it. She wasn't exchanged.
Oh, okay.
Her folks were from over there.
But you said she brought home a Chinese girl.
No, this is my other oldest daughter. Yeah, she lived here. They were an exchange student. They went to school together.
Just wouldn't have been in the black school beforehand, right?
Right, well, she would not, Debbie would have never met her if we had segregated school.
I see.
And to the extent that they could sleep over and establish at least a friendship at that point, I thought was great.
Improvements were coming.
Well, yeah.
Do you think that most people agreed with you at the time?
I think at that time most people felt. I mean, you know, because let's face it, it was a tremendous burden on the African American community. But that's where did most of the busing. But you have to realize that I think most of them at that time felt that was a price we had to pay to ensure that our kids got the quality of education. Now, see, what we did not anticipate, what they did not anticipate is the resegregation once you walk through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you go over here and the advanced program go over here and then y'all came, you know, that type of thing. But, you know, the reality is, and I think the way we looked at it, to teach the East End person's child, you had to teach my child, because they're in the same class. You know, in your
East End being generally white back then.
General white and upper income. The problem is with your poor white and your African American, they would get teachers that nobody else wanted. They don't fire them; they just recycle them. They send them where nobody's going to complain. So you had that problem. So you know, I often viewed a lot of white teachers, and to some extent, blacks. Would only go to a poor white or black school, only to wait until they had enough seniority to go to a place where kids want to learn. If kids wanted to learn. But you know, I'm big into teacher expectancy, so if you think they don't want to learn, then you ain't going to teach them.
Right.
And you know, I think that happens, and probably today still happens to some extent.
Okay. Now, what was, you're being a member of the state House of Representatives now, and I guess did Mr. Hines precede you? Do you have the same basic seat that he had, or has it been, maybe
it's changed a lot because of reapportionment, but I guess.
Overlap.
Sort of like, yeah.
And then, Norm Bloom?
Norbert Bloom.
Norbert Bloom uh-huh. was before that. Now, uh-huh. do you remember the...
Norbert Bloom was the Speaker of the House at one point.
Right, do you remember the Bloom bill, the merger bill? I figured maybe since he's from around here, did you get involved with that, or do you just recall
it? I recall it, and other than that, I don't recall enough at this point to add anything to the interview with it.
Understand. Were you at the trials for this desegregation suit? What were the trials like? The courtroom, did you stand up and ask questions to witnesses?
No, I think basically settled to most of them and Tom. You know, it was trying to show that there were still vestiges of discrimination. And, you know, I think we lost on the first round. It's only in Sixth Circuit turned them around. And Gordon got the margin. When Sixth Circuit came down, he didn't play. He got busy. Doing an order. And I recall we was in his office one day, and of course a lot of people was upset with him. And one of the lawyers said, "Judge, somebody wants to know who you think you are, God or somebody?" And God leaned back and said, "Any resemblance is purely coincidental."
Any semblance is purely coincidental.
I think, you know, he at first didn't side with us, but once Sixth Circuit turned him around, he went to work, and he was committed to seeing that this worked, and it worked.
Did he get a pretty good respect, you think, from the citizenry of the...
Well, you know, those who didn't like it was, you know, calling him everything but the child of God. I think there was a great deal of respect for Gordon, and Gordon sort of had a hands-on approach to the deseg. You know, I mean, he didn't order it and just go someplace.
You think that was necessary?
Yeah, I think it was necessary. I think it was important for them to understand the federal judge said this is going to happen, and he's going to make sure it happened. I'm not saying it would have come unglued, but, you know, having him there with the authority of his office, you know, I think probably gave the city and the county folks the nerve to do what they had to do.
Mm-hmm. What was that division like? I've heard stories about the city and county back then. I mean,
well, the county was, you know, it was, they had a different, they didn't have, most of the African Americans were in the city, and the county was predominantly, at least at that time, white. They were not happy campers. I mean, when you talk about most of the demonstrations, they were in the county. They weren't in the city. Now, I'm sure there were a number of folks in the city that weren't happy. But they didn't demonstrate as, let's say, out on Preston Highway, I think, was where they really heard a lot of that stuff. You know, it's most of that happened in the county. That's why they were calling the kids a name as they were walking, you know, throwing rocks at the buses. But Gordon made it clear that this was going to happen, and mm-hmm. it happened.
Did your daughter suffer any abuse or?
No, we had to. I went through a period where they couldn't answer the phone because when people found out I was involved, and they want to call me at all hours of mm-hmm. the night and share with me their opinion. And my then wife and I felt that it wasn't helpful to have the kids pick up the phone and hear some of the things.
What were some of the things that you heard? I mean, you take some abuse for that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, but I mean, I wasn't really worried about it because most of them probably wasn't going to come to the West End to do anything
just
anyway.
Just phone calls, just crank calls, mostly.
Yeah. Hours, different hours of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're going to kill you and what they're going to do to your kid, you know, that type of stuff.
But, yeah.
I didn't get that, you know, that concerned about it. I wasn't scared, let's put it that way.
Did the school administrators in the city and the school administrators in the county, you know, how would you, what do you recall of their cooperation and following the order? I mean, was that?
I think everybody followed the order. I mean, you know, you can sense, I mean, I can do it, you know, I can do it and I can do it. You know what I mean? And obviously there were some people that were not happy with it. But, you know, I mean, you sort of do what you have to do. If the boss says go that way, I mean, I really don't want to. But if you say the boss says that I got to go, I'll go. And so I think you could sense the differences in, you know, in the
enthusiasm
level. Or the lack of enthusiasm. But, you know, it worked. It worked. I mean, we got through the demonstrations and things, and you know, and you know, it's sort of interesting. The kids got on the football team and basketball team. They were good kids. Plus, that's always the way. You know, we can run and shoot. You know, we just can't do nothing else. So,
Well, tell me about things since then. I know I know there's been some movement to kind of preserve Central as a black institution, I think. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I think that's fair, because that's the last thing we have. I mean, you know, the city has a lot of history. You don't preserve history by turning down everything that represented the African-American history in this city or this county. I think most of us, of course, we probably die off at some point. The other kids won't obviously have the attachment to Central because they didn't go to Central. That many of us had, but you know, most of the folks around my area, I mean, that was it. So you know, we feel quite strongly about Central and its continued existence, because it's important that at least as a symbol, that'll be the only, maybe outside of some elementary schools, that well, and Z, institutions that African Americans attended that have an African American heritage. It has an African-American history.
Is there a move to you know, I don't know the percentage of black to white at Central now. I think it is predominantly black again, isn't it?
I don't know.
50%.
Is it? Okay.
I think. I'm not sure. But, you know, how... I guess what I'm trying to ask here, just as a general question, how the families and maybe the next generation after that DSEG order that are out there now, are they wanting to kind of maybe not turn things back to the way they were, but to have schools be more identifiable, and not just in terms of preserving the building and the heritage, but in the daily operation of the school? You understand what I'm trying to ask here? I mean, is there a movement for black students to be taught by black teachers? Is that kind of thing going on?
No, I don't see that.
Preserving the building and the...
Yeah, I think it's preserving the building.
Okay.
I don't think it's about, you know, I think it's important for us to have a black principal there.
Is there one there now, or do you know?
It always has been.
Is that right? Okay.
It always has been. Because, you know, you've always had white principals at Mayo.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't mean that nobody else can't do it, but, you know, there's a certain...
connection.
And that's part of preserving that history. But, you know, again, I think presently, you know, there's a case pending in the Supreme Court now.
Right, right.
So it might be a new day this time next year. If they go back to neighborhood schools, I see some real problems. For our kids, because again, you're going to have, I think the desegregation of the school ethnically is as important as the socioeconomic mix. And I think you're going to miss that if you go back to what you call neighborhood schools. Because, you know, you still have areas that are identifiable by their ethnicity or socioeconomic level. And if we go back to that, I think
you have an imbalance again.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, and just in terms of resources,
And interest in the school, probably.
Know, and I'm not saying that every teacher that teaches in a black school, a poor white school, doesn't want to be there. But a lot of them don't. They get it because they knew. All they want to do is get their seniority and move where kids want to learn. These kids don't want to learn. You know. You talk to teachers every day, they tell you, well, the parents don't, not supportive. Well, the kids still have to be taught, even the parents not supportive. I mean, you have to teach. That's my view. I would be nice if the parents were supportive. But just because the parents not supportive, do you doom the kid and say, well, you can't learn because your mama, she don't know nothing. And, you know, she's not supportive, so I just pass you right on through. I'm not going to teach you. I think you'll see that.
Okay. And then how would you characterize race relations in the city in the last maybe 10 to 20 years?
Tense. It's one of those things we don't really talk about in a meaningful way. I think, you know, there are undercurrents. I think most recently you had it with the police, you know, some police activity. I don't think race relations are as good as many would have you believe. Fortunately, we just haven't had that one catalyst to light the fire. And maybe I'm wrong. This is not a city or state that African Americans feel like they are involved in. Included in meaningful ways in a number of things.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to tell me?
Nope.
All right. I appreciate your time today. Thanks a lot.
Okay.